1330 WEBY, Northwest Florida's Talk Radio. This is Your Turn, a live call-in show featuring spirited discussion and debate about issues that matter to the community. Your Turn is sponsored by People's First Community Bank, the best bank in the neighborhood. Stay with us to hear what Northwest Florida thinks. Better yet, call in at 623-1330 and tell us what you think. It's your turn here on 1330 WEBY, Northwest Florida's Talk Radio. Now, here's the host of Your Turn.
Good afternoon. My name's Renee Giacchino. I'm corporate counsel for the Center for Individual Freedom, and I'll be the host for the next 2 hours of this version of Your Turn, the program that I've dubbed Meeting Nonsense with Common Sense. As always, if you want to learn more about my organization, I encourage you to visit our website at www.cfif.org, where you can sign up for our free Lunchtime Liberty Update. It'll show up every Friday in your mailbox, filled with lots of interesting information about what's happening inside and outside the Beltway, what's happening with respect to legal reform, and a whole host of other issues that matter no matter where you live. Joining me this afternoon is Tom Kirby. He's a senior litigation partner at the Washington, D.C. law firm of Wiley Rhine. He handles complex policy-oriented trial and appellate matters nationwide. And he joins us this afternoon for our annual Supreme Court Roundup. Tom Kirby, thank you so much for joining us.
Renee, it's a pleasure to be here.
Thank you. If you will, please, first, tell us a little bit about the practice that you do there at Wiley Rhine. I know a lot of your practice is appellate-level practice. What does that really mean, Tom?
Well, there's two kinds of courtroom fighting that people do. And the first kind is at the trial level, where it's often in front of a jury, and the issue is what facts can you bring together to persuade somebody that you're right and he's wrong at a factual level, although there's certainly a legal component to it. Once that record is compiled, then the appeal process starts. And at that point, you have a fixed record that the courts are dealing with. And the question is, as a matter of law and policy, how should things come out? I enjoy trial a lot, but the fact of the matter is that the reported decisions that shape the law across the country tend to come out at the appellate level.
And at the appellate level, the highest court in the United States, of course, is the U.S. Supreme Court, that which we're going to talk about this afternoon.
None higher.
Right. Now, the U.S. Supreme Court just finished what I think is it correct? They call it their 06 term. Is that what we've been in?
That's right.
Okay, their 06 term. Let me start out by asking you your impression as an appellate lawyer. There's been a lot written over the last year or two, maybe even going back four or five into the Rehnquist term. Of course, now we're in you know, the Roberts Court. They name them, I guess, by their chief justice. But that the court has cut back its docket year after year after year, despite the fact that there are probably more cases being filed, cert petitions being filed, asking the court to take on cases. What has been your impression, Tom?
Well, it's not a matter of impression, Renee. If you just count, this last term they decided 68 cases, and you have to go back decades to find a term when only 68 cases were decided. That being said, I'm not sure this is a bad thing. The Supreme Court exists primarily to decide those few policy-oriented questions where the lower courts have perhaps gotten out of whack and they need some guidance at the national level. And frankly, if the Supreme Court can focus on 68 cases a year and do a bang-up job, that's wonderful. Now, some people may question whether they're doing the bang-up job, but standing alone, I don't think just the number of cases should be particularly troubling.
Okay, we're going to go through just a handful of them. Certainly, listeners out there, if you've got a case that you want to hear about or a certain issue you want to know whether or not the Supreme Court addressed it this past term, please feel free to give us a call, as always, at 623-1330. I'm going to start in an area where I know you are most certainly an expert, and that's because you represented Senator McConnell and the U.S. Chamber of Commerce in a First Amendment challenge, the infamous McCain-Feingold case. It was called McConnell versus FEC back in 2003. That case per se was not back before the court, but certainly issues surrounding McCain-Feingold, that's the campaign finance law that we've talked about many times on this program, was before the court again with a very recent decision. What can you tell us about that, Tom?
Well, thank you for starting off by reminding everyone of perhaps my most highly publicized failure. You're right that back in 2003, my firm represented Senator McConnell and a coalition of others in attacking various aspects of the McCain-Feingold bill. And the portion that we were most concerned about was a portion that cut back on the ability of corporations and trade unions to speak out on public issues during the time of election. The way the bill was written, a corporation could not broadcast any commentary that mentioned the name of a congressman or senator 30 days before the primary or 60 days before the general election. So Congress basically knew if they put issues the corporations cared about during that period, they were insulated from criticism by the corporations and in the media that matter most. We strongly argued that was a violation of the First Amendment. We convinced four of the justices, but the Supreme Court practice is a matter of counting to five, and the four liberals plus Justice O'Connor did us in. So that's the background to what was happening this last term.
And now we have two new justices, of course, last term with Alito and Roberts joining. Has the pendulum begun to swing in the opposite direction, Tom?
Yeah, yes, it sure has. And to editorialize for a second, thank goodness. What happened in this case was there was a corporation, and it was an ideological corporation, but nonetheless a corporation that had been running ads asking people in Wisconsin to call their senators and tell them to stop filibustering President Bush's nomination of federal judges. And they did mention the senators' names. Well, the election began to approach, and this organization had to take its ads off the air because all of a sudden they were within 30 days of a primary, even though the filibuster was continuing in Congress. The judges were not being confirmed. And after a long, bloody fight, the U.S. Supreme Court, in a 5-4 decision with the two new justices, this time on the right side of things, in more ways than one, decided that without reversing the McConnell decision that McCain-Feingold was okay on its face, they said that when you try to apply that standard to corporate speech that could be understood to be doing things other than advocating vote for or vote against a congressman, that the First Amendment protected that. Now, Justice Scalia and Thomas strongly criticized this decision for not having the guts to just come right out and strike down McCain-Feingold, but that's sort of in Justice Roberts' style, is to work incrementally, and that's what he was doing here.
Speaking of Justice Roberts' style, I'm not sure whether or not you've seen, I need to find my notes on this, but I've seen some pretty interesting articles lately about comments back and forth between some of the justices. Justice Scalia maybe having some pretty interesting comments to make as it relates perhaps to our head justice. What's your take on all of that?
Scalia's a wonderful man. I don't know him personally, but I have been around him. And he speaks pretty forcefully sometimes. There is not, to my knowledge, any bad blood between Justice Scalia and Chief Justice Roberts. But Scalia likes to paint often with a broader brush, and he likes to decide cases as a matter of clear principle. And he has been frustrated several times recently when he felt that Roberts and Alito were not being entirely clear as to a rationale for what they did. In this Wisconsin Right to Life case we were talking about, Scalia felt that, look, come on, you've basically overturned the McCain-Feingold decision. Why don't you just come out and say you've overturned it? Interestingly, the four dissenters felt the same way and said the same thing, except they didn't want it overturned, of course. But they said, look, you've really overturned this statute. You're just not admitting it. And there have been a couple cases over this past term where Scalia has felt like the effect of a Roberts decision will be broader than the rhetoric that Roberts used, and it just frustrated Scalia, I think.
Yeah, I mean, it's very interesting. There was an article in the New York Times written by Linda Greenhouse, and she essentially characterizes it as one justice calling another a wimp and a hypocrite, although he didn't do it in exactly those words. I could never imagine Scalia using either of those terms to describe anyone. He used more appropriate language, I guess, for a justice, faux judicial modesty was,
right.
I guess, how he termed it. Now, let me ask you this. We're down here along the Gulf Coast. Why should we care about this campaign finance case, Tom? Why should we care what the Supreme Court even took this case, let alone how they decided it?
Well, the Supreme Court in this case was deciding a First Amendment issue, and the principles that it was laying down in this case govern not only how the federal election system is going to work, but how various state systems are going to work. And as you'll recall, just a couple of years ago, we ended up challenging a state statute in Louisiana that restricted the corporate speech in very much the same way as the federal statute. And we had to fight it up to the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Fifth Circuit, which is the federal court of appeals that handles that part of the country, Louisiana, dealing with the same kind of issues we're talking about here. And the issue there was, were people in Louisiana going to get to hear what corporations thought about issues that were affecting corporations down there?
All right, let's talk about another case recently decided, and that has to do with student speech. Tell me about that one.
This is the Bong Hits for Jesus case.
Bong Hits for Jesus case. I mean, something, again, that I don't think that we'd ever expect those words to be uttered by any Supreme Court justice, but that's exactly what was on the poster or T-shirt. Which was it that the student in Alaska had?
It was a poster. He was holding up across from the school during a parade that the students had been let out to observe. I think it was an Olympic parade or something like
yes,
that.
Yes, I believe you're right, the torch coming through town or something. So what happened?
Well, the Supreme Court there, it was an interesting departure from some of their earlier cases. You'll recall back in the Vietnam era, the Supreme Court announced that students were sort of fully protected or almost fully protected in many speech activities, and wearing black armbands was protected, and some other sort of T-shirt slogans, I think, got protected. But here, the Supreme Court really felt like this wasn't a case of political speech that was being suppressed. Indeed, when the student was asked, what did that banner mean? He said it didn't really mean anything. It was just intended to provoke a controversy and get him on TV. And the Supreme Court just basically said, schools don't have to tolerate impertinence. There's a certain amount of, in a school, you have to control student speech. You say, Billy, stand up and tell us what you know. Sam, be quiet while Billy's talking. Susie, tell us what you think. You're controlling speech all the time, and if those poor teachers have to allow disruptive activity that's intended basically just to be impertinent, they have a hopeless job. And so the Supreme Court wasn't entirely together on its rationale, but it boiled down to schools don't have to put up with this kind of stuff.
Do you think this is the beginning of a trend where we may see with other cases that come up involving students an erosion of their constitutional rights, those that they had? I mean, I know you don't check them when you enter through the schoolhouse doors, although they're lesser than they would be, you know, outside the schoolhouse. But you think this is any indication? And maybe how does Virginia Tech or any of that play into this?
Boy, I'm going to have grave difficulty in tying this to Virginia Tech at all. But
okay.
But just in general, I think the Supreme Court is going to continue to be respectful of serious speech by students. I really do. You have the four liberals who even wanted to protect Bong Hits for Jesus. You have Justice Kennedy, who always has been respectful of speech. And it was really only Justice Thomas, who I admire in many ways, but it was really only Justice Thomas who said, I want to just forget about the First Amendment in schools. So the other justices, they didn't quite, I think, know how to articulate, how to draw the line. But they simply thought, without drawing that line clearly, this had gone too far. I don't think a student who is respectfully attempting to make a reasonable, it doesn't matter what's reasonable, to make a genuine point in a way that's not disrupting class is going to have a problem.
So as a First Amendment advocate, this truly doesn't offend you then?
No, because I'm also a father, and I also was a rambunctious student, and you know, it could go too far. But I do think that reasonable control of what goes on in schools, including who says what when, is just a part of the school experience. I think you can't really get away from that.
Okay. Tom, we need to take a very quick break. And when we come back, I want to stay in school and talk about probably what is one of the biggest issues that the court took up this year, and that is whether public school districts can take account of race in assigning students to schools. If you've got a question, we're talking with Tom Kirby. He is a senior litigation partner at Wiley Ryan in Washington, D.C., and we're doing our annual Supreme Court roundup. When we come back from this break, please feel free to call in at 623-1330, and it'll be your turn. We'll be right back.
Now, back to your turn on 1330 WEBY, Northwest Florida's Talk Radio. The phone lines are open, so call in and join the conversation at 623-1330.
First off, a little bit of housekeeping. Let me let the listeners know and thank those who have called in to say that they're having a hard time picking up the signal or it's a weak signal. I don't have to tell you that we've had these thunderstorms roll through here, but what I will tell you is that we do have a Gulf Power truck working on our transmitter site. We are having to run on very little power right here from the station, but they're working on it, and hopefully they will have it up very shortly so you can continue to listen to this version of Your Turn, the program I've dubbed Meeting Nonsense with Common Sense. We're going to finish up the rest of this half hour talking with Tom Kirby. He is a senior litigation partner at Wiley Ryan in Washington, D.C., and we're doing our annual Supreme Court roundup. Okay, we're staying in school right now, and we're moving on to what some have called probably the biggest issue for the Supreme Court to take up this term. What is it, Tom?
Well, it's the question of the use of race in deciding where students should go to school. And it is an absolutely hot potato issue. The court got to this case on the very last day of its term, and it was amusing. I was watching on the Internet some of my colleagues who were doing a panel discussion of the Supreme Court roundup, and this decision hadn't come out. And they all had their cell phones with their little speakers in their ear during their presentation, and about 10:12, all of a sudden they jumped up and they had that decision, and that's what they talked about. It's a really, as everyone knows, it's a very hard decision. And this particular decision involved two communities where it seemed like it wasn't really controversial in the communities the way that race was being used to assign students to particular schools, but nonetheless, there were particular students who objected, and they brought suit. And the Supreme Court, in a 5-4 decision, decided that if equal protection means anything, it means that you cannot take every student, classify him by race, and then decide where he goes to school or doesn't go to school based on his race. The majority opinion, again, Chief Justice Roberts, just said, look, when we go back to the Brown versus Board of Education case, they weren't focused on the fact that the black schools were worse than the white schools. They were, of course, but that wasn't the focus of the decision. The focus of the decision was that it is just not right to classify Americans on the basis of race and tell them what they can or can't do on that basis. And he ended his decision by saying, if racial discrimination is the problem, then the first thing to do in addressing that is to stop discriminating on the basis of race. Now, the four dissenters, the liberals, and I use that term because it's convenient to identify the left wing and the right wing, if you will, just thought that was too simple, and they thought that there was a real difference between using racial classifications to include people, which is what they view the government is doing now, and to exclude people, which is what they thought was happening back in the 50s. But it was just you could tell from the papers, it was a very hard-fought decision. And again, you had Justice Kennedy sort of playing the balancing act. He was the swing vote, and he said, well, I agree that this use of race goes too far, but maybe a little bit of use of race where you really need to and you can really justify it may be okay. So all of the schools out there across America are sitting there scratching their heads and wondering, what can they do next year? But it is clear that they're going to be much more careful about how they use race in student assignments and those kinds of things.
And where they draw the line, sure.
Yeah.
All right, one final case. We've got about 2 minutes left. Again, we're going to stay in school because I've already seen the football players out there on the field running around. Friday night lights sure burn bright down here on the Gulf Coast. Tell us the decision that impacts high school sports recruiting.
Well, it was, and let's see here. I'm going to come up with the name of it. Was it Hine versus Freedom? No, it was...
let's see. It involved Tennessee, so
yeah. I have a note
Tennessee secondary school Brentwood Academy. There we go.
That's right. There we go. One of my great weaknesses, Renee, is I can never remember the name of the case. But that actually turned out to be a fairly easy case for the court once they focused on it. What had happened was that a coach at a school that belonged to one of these athletic associations had sent out recruiting letters earlier than he was supposed to. And when the association went to sanction him in his school, he said, oh, it's First Amendment. I'm entitled to send letters to anyone I want, saying anything I want. And he didn't quite say that bluntly, but that was the thrust of his argument. And the Supreme Court said, no, if you're going to join an association, then the association can have reasonable rules, even if it's a government-sponsored organization. And regulating recruiting is a reasonable thing for an association like this to do, and the fact that your particular form of violation was writing a letter isn't going to get you off the hook. You can't invoke the First Amendment. That's a general principle in the law. I mean, the law forbids fraud. Well, if you commit fraud by talking, that doesn't give you a First Amendment defense. The law forbids conspiracy. If you commit a conspiracy by talking to one another, that doesn't give you a First Amendment defense. And the Supreme Court was pretty unanimous, I think. I don't remember the exact vote. In basically holding that an association like this can, in fact, regulate recruiting activity.
Okay, very good. Well, that's all the time we have this time for our Supreme Court Roundup, and maybe what I'll ask you to do is, as October begins to draw near, we can talk about what's going to be on their plate next fall. You can join us again, and maybe we can even revisit some of the other decisions, like the other association-related decision, the union case, and others we didn't get a chance to cover. But Tom Kirby, thank you so much for joining us. We've been talking with Tom Kirby, a senior litigation partner at Wiley Ryan in Washington, D.C. Thanks, Tom.
Thanks, Renee. Goodbye.